Do you have solo economic dependency? That is, if you aren't working, you aren't making money. The Art of Passive Income podcast is the solution. Discover passive income models so you can enjoy life on your own terms. Let freedom ring.
Hey, it's Mark Biddle from the Landgeek, their favorite niche real estate website, www.thelandgeek.com. And today's going to be a special podcast. We're actually going to mix it up a bit and provide all of you land geekers a taste of the best of the best segments of our roundtable podcast, which have been immensely popular. So sit back with a latte or an espresso or an Americano or some kind of caffeinated drink, maybe a bulletproof coffee like me, and enjoy the best of the best of our roundtable segments.
Let's talk about a very important topic. Scott Todd, what's the topic for the roundtable discussion this week?
Well, I'm just curious, you know, like, let's say that you're talking to somebody who wants to buy some land and, like, I don't know, you're talking to them and they want to buy, let's say, I don't know, 15 acres from you and all you have is five. Like, do you try to match up and try to find out, like, try to find another property for them, like buy it wholesale or something? Or do you just take their number so that maybe you start mailing to 15 acre properties to try to find that match? Or, like, what do you do? I mean, we had an interesting sale I want to use to kind of motivate everybody, but I'd love to know what kind of everybody's thought process on that would be. And two-part question. Let's say it's not just a county that you're working in, but let's say it's another county. Like, you don't even do anything in the county. What would you do?
Bearland Aaron, what are your thoughts?
I used to kind of throw them away, but since Landmodo, I've started doing the thing where I'll look, you know, when somebody contacts me, if I don't have it, I'll tell them, hey, I don't have one exactly like that right now, but some of my colleagues may have something that they'd be willing to sell me. Let me check it out. And, you know, I'll go through Landmodo and see if there's anything that we can maybe work with and contact the person if, you know, there's a wholesale price there, or maybe if it's just right, I might contact them anyway, whether they listed it for wholesale or not. Now, as far as in the county I'm working or not, I would say, like, a lot of times if that probably happens, it might be in the county I'm working anyway because the advertisements, but because I do advertise places that aren't necessarily where I'm working, you know, looking for people that are just buying, I would definitely look in those areas. Now, the difference is if I find something, I might be a little less inclined to go that route if it's somewhere like even another state that I'm not working. But if it's somebody that I really have a lot of trust for, then I would probably do it because I know that their due diligence is going to be super solid. I know that, you know, even if it fell apart and I got stuck with it, that they're probably in a pretty good area that I could, you know, I could sell it if I had to, or even wholesale it off for at a zero net, which I never done, but would if I had to. So, yeah, definitely.
All right. Zen Master, Mike Zeno, what are your thoughts?
Well, since I know a lot of people on here looking at this, I'm going to listen to it anew. I'm going to go with a conservative approach. I want to give a little perspective on, you know, one side, just because I anticipate some. Because as you grow in this business, your skill set's going to grow, right? And your recognition of what a true buyer is going to grow, right? So I equate this to years ago, 30 years ago or about, I was trying my hand at auto sales. I was horrible, right? And so this guy came in and there was this Camaro. And if you sold this Camaro, you get an extra like $500 bonus. I'm like, this guy wants to take the Camaro for a ride. We go out, he's bebopping around, comes back. And he puts some ridiculous offer in. I go to the manager. He's like, looks over. He goes, that guy's in here every week test driving that thing. And I'm like, he's not going to buy it. He just comes in and takes advantage of the new sales guy. So point being, if I'm not really good at this business yet, I'm not really new and I'm still figuring it out, I don't think that I would advise someone in the beginning to put a whole lot of effort into someone saying, well, geez, I'm working in Colorado and somebody wants something in Florida. Well, let me go get that for you, because you go through a lot of work with no guaranteed sale and it's diverting you from your focus, which should be in the primary beginning, get your feet moving, get rolling. and get those mailings consistent, stick to your area, put that guy on your buyers list, right? But so in a conservative approach, I'm going to say, if you're new to this business, no, just say, oh, I get land all the time. How about I put you on my buyers list? I'll keep you posted. But I wouldn't then go venture out in the beginning. I think you got to stay highly focused.
Yeah, I think that's a great answer. And it kind of reminds me that this podcast is sponsored by Flight School. And if you want to talk to the Zen Master, Mike Zano, and get these kinds of really intelligent type of answers to your issues and strategy, get on a call with Mike, get on a call with Scott, just go to landgeek.com/training and do that. Or go to landgeek.com/free coaching and schedule a call. All right, moving on to the technician, Eric Peterson. What are your thoughts?
So from time to time, I will get people that are asking for, you know, land that I don't currently have. More often than not, it's going to be in an area that I've worked in before or that I'm currently working in. So when that happens, you know, I'm more likely to go out and see if I can source something. However, you know, at the same time that I'm kind of making that, deciding whether or not it's worthwhile, you know, I'm trying to assess that particular potential buyer, right? To see if they're really serious, because I mean, so often, you know, we talk to buyers that are, you know, they're not happy with whatever option you might have, and they just start throwing out things, you know, well, I want this or I want that. Or, so I guess, you know, if you have a good feeling about that buyer and you feel like they're going to stand behind what they're looking for and, you know, it's worth your while, then it makes sense to go out and look and, see if you could find something wholesale. I've certainly done it. My fear when you go outside of the areas you typically work in is that, you know, if you execute that transaction and, that buyer actually, you know, locks up the property and you purchased it, if they default, the issue is that, you know, that's not an area that you typically market in. So you're going to be left with that property and kind of starting from scratch, right? So, you know, when you first sold it, it made sense because it was an easy sale. But if that buyer falls off and stops making payments, you know, and let's say you work in Colorado normally and this property's in California, that's a big difference in market. And going out there and finding a new buyer on that property is not going to be super easy. It's not like you can just start using all your Colorado accounts or what have you, or your buyer's list for Colorado, et cetera. Not to say it can't be done, but just be aware of that going into it if you decide to kind of go outside your standard area.
All right. I love it. Terrorist Hunter, Mimi Schmidt, what are your thoughts?
They're exactly right. It's not a black or white yes or no question. There's a lot more to it. Stay focused. I had a request last week for property in Erie or Firestone, Colorado, between Denver and Boulder. Yep, too expensive, not anywhere near I'm ever going to be. So, yeah, I'll add you to buyer's list if you find something great. Otherwise, no. But if it's in an area that you know, if it's an area on Landmodo and you're familiar with the property there, then maybe you can make it work. I even did this once for a guy, bought a property for me in Costilla, owned it for a couple months and said, yeah, I'd rather be up in Park. So I found him one, tripled the amount of money I was bringing in a month on my monthly payment, and then he defaulted. His wife got pregnant. He didn't want to do it. So now it's in the same state even. So I have all of the Craigslist marketing, IP addresses. I have all that. But I don't know anything about Park. I don't have a photographer in Park. So most of the time it works out. But I just warn you to stay in the areas you know the inventory that's available for you to pull from on some of these wholesaling capable sites.
Very sagacious answer. Big Papa, Tate Litchfield, what are your thoughts?
This is a really interesting topic, and I'm going to do a little shameless plug here, because I was recently in this situation, and some of our viewers or our listeners aren't aware, but I'm working on a new project and it's called Lots. And in one of the episodes that I recorded, I had a situation where a VIP client called me up and said, "Hey, here's what I'm looking for. Do you have any more of that?" And I didn't. And so I went out and I found that property for him. I purchased it kind of at noon that same day. He made a down payment for it at 1 o'clock that fall, that same day. So in this type of situation, I would absolutely bend over backwards to accommodate kind of a VIP client or somebody that I know is serious. Again, if it's a property in a location where it can be a good location, but you know, it just might not speak to me, I'm not going to go out of my way to find it. I'd rather pass that lead on to a friend and say, "Hey, Scott, I don't have what this guy wants. I know you're the man for this area. You know, you owe me dinner," kind of thing. I'd rather do that. And I've had plenty of people pass me leads that resulted in sales. And, you know, that's just kind of being a good friend, taking care of those that you respect. So that's what I would say I most often do. But, you know, there's a place, and I'll leave it up to Scott, there's a place where I go and I treat it as my personal inventory. And anytime I need anything, I can guaranteed find it on Landmodo. So that's what I would do.
I like it. I like it. Scott Todd. Oh, by the way, LOT stands for Looking Over Tate's Shoulder. And we're all excited for that sort of, we'll call it Geek Flicks show to come out. Lots. Scott Todd, tell us a story.
All right, so here's the story. We had a guy that we've been talking to for a while. He's never bought from me. And it gives me that one piece right there gives me a little bit of heartburn. But we've been talking to him for a while. And what he wanted was, he wanted a 15-acre property in this area where I have other land, but I didn't have 15 acres. I mean, like, I do have 15 acres, but not all together. And he wanted it all together. So we've been trying to work a deal with him, and he just wanted 15 or more. He wanted larger properties. And in our conversations with him, we basically said, "Well, how much money are you looking to put down?" And he's like, "Well, I will put down half of the purchase price." And we're like, "Wow, okay, half of the purchase price. That's a pretty reasonable deal, right? That's a pretty solid buyer right there." So what happened was, we actually found one of these properties, one of these 15 acres on Landmodo. So we went out and we basically secured the land, made sure that it was available, and that it was actually being wholesaled on there. The wholesale price, I think, is a little bit higher than what I normally like, because I normally like to be able to double my money. But the asking price is probably about $900 higher. I think we tried to negotiate and it didn't happen. But we're like, okay, let's just go ahead and look at this deal. So we ended up buying this 15-acre property for $9,900. And we sold it for $17,900, which happens to be the exact same asking price as the person we bought it from. That's what they were looking to sell it for as well. And so essentially, by doing that, we were able to turn around and match one of our buyers. And again, we had been talking to this guy for like over a year, and we could never kind of connect with him. And so basically, we ended up buying that property wholesale and getting the $8,900 wholesale price, if you will. And then we turned around and sold it. And so we're going to get, I think, like $100 a month for the next 120 months, 10 years. $120 a month for 120 years, it works out to be 149% yield on our investment. Not bad, right? But, you know, I think it brings up the point that, and there's been a lot of good conversations. One, and I hear this from people sometimes, like, "Well, you know, should I chase the deal?" And it's so easy to kind of really want to make a deal that you start to chase, and you start to chase it all over the country. And, you know, as been pointed out, then you end up with a property that you really don't want to own after they default. And you have to assume that every deal that you enter into is going to default. There's no guaranteed deal that it won't default, unless it's a cash deal. And then, you know, then it's probably not going to default. But any terms deal you have is probably likely to default, or you should treat it like it is. So if you're crisscrossing the country looking for available land, well, I think you're making a fatal flaw, because you're going to end up with a bunch of stuff that you may not be able to sell. And as Mimi said, like, you know, it could be somewhere that's, it could even be in the same state, but it's not where you do business. And then it's like, man, it's trying to start up the whole machine all over again.
Right. So just to recap, the algorithm then is chase a deal for a potential buyer only if it's an area that you are comfortable working or you're currently working. In that worst case, you would still want to own that property.
Yeah.
Did I miss that?
You got it. No, you got it.
Okay.
Because you got to believe, man, like every terms deal you sell, you have to assume it's going to default at some point in time. So then what is your strategy? What is your plan B? And if your plan B is like, oh, I never thought they'd default. Well, you have a bad plan from the get-go.
Hey, Scott, question on that deal. Are you guys offering 90-day money-back guarantee on that still?
We are. That's the thing that gives me a little bit of heartburn here, right? So like before you enter a deal like that, you need to be confident, like one, that you're going to be able to resell that property even if you took it back. And I think it was Aaron that said, like, even if I do a wash on it, will I still be okay? Well, I'll still be okay, but it's an area that I know that I'll be able to sell into in the future.
Yeah, I mean, but
you've got to be able to write that check come time to do it.
I was going to say, like, I would do this deal all day long, but I would probably keep his down payment kind of in reserve in case, you know, on that 89th day, he came to me and said, hey, it's not working out. I need to break up with you. I want my money back. I would keep that money just on the sidelines, but on that 90th day, boom, I'm going to town, right? It's getting redeployed.
Yeah. I don't think you want to, what's the line in Top Gun? Don't write checks your body can't cash, right? Like, right. Don't put yourself in a spot that you're like, oh boy, that's the end of it. Don't do that. Don't do that.
No. Did you get a doxy? No.
We did get a doxy.
Of course, yes, you got, course a got a doxy.
Come on, man.
No, I'm not surprised. I'm not
newbies
surprised.
Around here.
No, I'm just saying that boosts you up a little bit even better. So, I mean, at this point, I would have done that deal, no doubt.
So listen, I think we have a cool topic for today. A few weeks ago, we talked about kind of some case studies. We did a roundtable and some case studies, some of like our last deals. And we wanted to reverse the tables a little bit today. And we wanted to really share with you guys our biggest mistakes, if you will. Because look, the reality is that we're all going to make mistakes. And sometimes people make mistakes. And you're going to make mistakes too if you're doing any type of real estate. The cool thing that I have found is that in the mistakes that I've made, they've all been fixable. Now, maybe for you guys, it's not that way, but let's see. Let's just go around and let's just first go to Scott Bossman. Scott, biggest mistake, man. I'm sure you've made one. What is it?
Oh, I've made a lot of mistakes. The biggest is I did a deal. It actually, well, it was probably a year and a half ago now. I bought two properties from a guy, and one of the properties was joint tenants with his deceased wife, and one of the properties was tenants in common with his deceased wife. And I got a little bit lost in the shuffle and purchased both the properties. The joint tenants property I was able to purchase with the death certificate of his wife, but the other property I then became ownership with his deceased wife because he technically should have gone through probate before I purchased that property. So that was a couple $100 mistake that was a big pain, but I was able to find a resource to help me address it and utilize a paralegal who kind of helped me wade through the waters, if you will, to get this deal fixed. So that was one of my biggest mistakes that caused a lot of frustration and hassle at the time. Whoa, I can't hear you.
Sorry, it was fixable. It just cost you a few $100.
Right.
Okay. All right. Well, that's not too bad. I mean, you know, at least you got it fixed and, you know, resolved and you move forward and still profitable on that deal, right?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. All right. Bearland, biggest mistake, man. What is it?
I may have talked about this one before, but I bought a property that was like the letter telling the landowner that the taxes or that the property was going up for tax sale went to the person I bought it from at about the same time that I bought the property. So I wasn't aware of it, and I didn't have a good handle on the amount of time in that particular area that property could have back taxes before it was going to go to sale. So I bought the property, marketed it, sold it, and got a letter from a gentleman who said, "Hey, I just want to let you know I own this property now because I redeemed the tax certificates on it." And so all of a sudden now I've got a customer paying a note on a property that I don't own. So I got a hold of the guy and we had a nice conversation. And, you know, luckily he was somebody that was willing to work with me. Wouldn't necessarily always be that lucky, but he sold me back the property for what he had in it, just because he was a pretty nice guy. So unfortunately, I didn't, you know, make a huge profit on that property, but I retained the note, and there's still a little bit of profit in that. So basically it became instead of something I bought, you know, for a quarter of market value, it became kind of like I bought a wholesale deal. So it worked out, you know, it was a mistake that could have been a lot worse. I could have had to refund my customer all that he had paid, but you know, it did work out. So, but that was a big one. I learned good lessons from that one.
And I think that's the thing too, right? Like I think that we are all scared to make mistakes, right? You know, like we no one wants to make a mistake. It's not fun making mistakes. The reality is that, you know, like for me, the way I always think about this is my investment is so small in these properties. You know, my average investment is $1,600 that if I made a mistake, I'm going to lose $1,600. That's my loss. But yet I've never lost one straight out, you know, but there is that potential, right? Like anytime you're doing something, there's the potential. And like you, your scenario that you just did, in a way you kind of lost the land. You were able to recover it. You know, lucky thing, you were able to recover it. But then at the same time, you learned a very valuable lesson along the way, right? Like this is something we got to check on in our due diligence. Like, man, how delinquent is this? And when are the taxes really coming due?
Absolutely.
Yeah. That's cool. Well, it's not cool for you, but it's cool that you were able to recover. All right. Let's go to Eric. Eric, biggest mistake, man.
I don't know. I've got a couple I want to talk about. So the first one, I was purchasing bulk properties. I think it was probably about a dozen properties from a seller, and paid them. They deeded me that group of properties. We recorded it, and a couple weeks later, got a letter back from the assessor saying these two properties on that deed already have been sold, or, you know, there's a different owner on them. They were sold prior to you making that purchase. And in the meantime, I'd actually taken a deposit to wholesale one of those. So quickly remedied that and refunded the buyer on the wholesale side, and was able to reach out to the seller. This was a seller I had a relationship with, so it wasn't a huge deal. But it was frustrating more than anything else, just kind of in the time part of it and dealing with getting it all resolved. But the seller gave me two other properties instead that were basically equivalent, and we worked it out that way. So that's one that comes to mind. The other one is this one's more just kind of around the business as a whole, and I often tell my coaching students this. When I got started, I had a full-time job and I was doing this on the side. And the passive income piece of this business became really important to me. You know, I didn't ever want to see that number go down. I always wanted it to go up and up. And because of that, I wasn't willing to sell any notes and recoup my capital faster and redeploy it back into the business. And that would have been the ideal time to do that. I would be much farther today if I was doing that while I had another job. I didn't need that income. You know, I had a lot more flexibility. Though those numbers were great on the passive side, you know, as they were growing and getting bigger and bigger, you know, I would have just been that much further along today if I was selling those notes back then and redeploying that capital. So that's kind of a, you know, kind of business strategy type mistake that I think is very hard for a lot of people just getting started to let go of some of that passive income because it feels so great. Most of us don't have that outside of this business. So as it starts to accumulate, it's hard to let it go. But the reality is if you've got full-time work outside of this business, that's your best time to utilize that strategy. So,
and you can always sell your notes at tlfolio.com. See, Mark would be proud of me for plugging that in there, right? Because he's the expert at that piece. But, you know, Eric, it's kind of cool that you talk about the selling of notes because I've always said that, and I did the same thing, right? Like I wanted that passive income, but while I didn't need the money, I went off and sold some of my notes to generate more capital to go buy more properties. And I talk about this in flight school. I talk about it. And every time I talk about my story, I talk about the fact that I leveraged other people's money. And to me, the safest way to do that is through selling just a portion of the note, sell 12 months of the note payment and move on. Now, the other component to that is, to me, it's a lot like playing Monopoly when you do that, because if you've ever played Monopoly, you know that like you go around the board and the goal is to collect as many properties as you can. And clearly you can't go out and you can't put a hotel, just you can't buy the property and then put a hotel on it, right? Like that's not the way that the rules work. But the more of these properties that you can accumulate on your first few times around the board, well, that's going to set you up for success later on. And I look at this the same way, is like, if I can pair off some of that passive income that I'm generating today, and I wouldn't say pair off all of it. Like I always say, like stick to a 50%, maximum of 50%. So if you have 200 a month coming in, we'll only sell one of the notes or, you know, $100 of that particular passive income stream. Because what you want to do is you want to be able to go around in that first few years and gather as many of these properties as you can. And then as the first 12 months come along and you cycle through it, all of a sudden now you've taken that someone else's capital and you've went out and deployed it at a much higher rate and you've bought all these other properties, and then your passive income is some substantial number higher. It's six, it's not necessarily 10X, but it all depends on how you deploy it. But if you deploy someone else's money, you're freeing up capital today to go do it. It just, to me, it's a no-brainer, but I get it. People want to hold on to it and protect it, and I would too. So I'm glad that you kind of looked at that and found that solution too. That's cool.
Yeah.
Mimi, what's your biggest mistake?
So I talked about it at the last boot camp. I had an accepted offer from a guy for like $1,175. He was a trucker who was traveling, so he let his friend work with me on the transaction. So, you know, it was to buy the property, okay? So I went and, it was to buy the property. Right? So I paid him for the property $1,175. And the guy's friend calls me back and goes, "You're a zero short. You owe us like $11,000 more." They thought, or he thought it was $11,750. Huh? So my stress level went through the roof. I was so stressed out. And the trucker and his friend were sending me the meanest, most obnoxious texts. And it was really upsetting to me, you know, and threatening to go to the sheriff. And you know, as a woman, I was really upset, but I would stop reading my texts and I would have my husband kind of scan them for anything that was important, like my daughter come pick me up, because I was so afraid to look at my phone. And so literally I was so afraid, I went back the next day, I swapped it back, the deeds back, so that he had the property. And I called the guy, "You're gonna send me my money back, right?" And, "Well, I'm on a 4-day trip." 4 days later, "Well, I spent the money." And I was so stressed out, and I knew my husband was gonna be so upset with me. But the check did come. It took about 10 days. But I don't know how that happened. I think it was because there was a middleman involved. He had accepted the offer on the offer letter, the piece of paper. But the friend saw how professional I was during the whole time, and that I didn't get nasty in response to what they were saying to me, that he's now looking at buying a really big piece of property from me. So it made a friend and a client in the process, just because I kept my cool and remained professional about the whole thing. But God, it was so stressful.
I mean, that is a very important part. Like being able to like remain professional, remain, you know, honest and transparent about it. And if you make a mistake or if there's a confusion, just give back the money. Like to me, that's the fastest way to build credibility around. And we actually had a guy that bought a property from us back in November, and he made his down payment of like $75, okay, and then he made his first month payment of like a couple $100, and then he stopped making payments, and he was actually delinquent. And we caught him. We're like, "Hey, what's going on?" And he's like, "Well, you know, you're not gonna give me the deed on the property, and I can't do what I want until after it's paid off." We're like, "That's right." He's like, "Well, this isn't going to work." And I'm like, "Well, just pay off the deed or pay 50%, you know, some substantial amount, so I know that you're in." He's like, "No, I'm not going to do that. And I want all my money back because you misled me." And he was after the 90-day return period, you know, like the swap period. And plus he was delinquent, which kind of negates that anyway, in my opinion. And, you know, he was talking to the sales rep that he dealt with, and she's like, I don't want to give him back his money." And I'm like, "He's going to be an energy vampire. Give him back his money." And she's like, "I'm not giving back his doc fee." I said, "Give him back his money." So she gave him back the money. I'm like, it's not worth it. Right? Like even if it was a cash deal, if you're not going to be fun to work with, man, get rid of that guy and move on to somebody else, because life's too short. And so like you said, like you could have argued over it and said, "No, this is the way that it is." The reality is you did the right thing, even though they were wrong. And look, you'll probably get a big sale out of it. You'll probably make more money than what you could have off the other one.
Yeah.
Maybe. Awesome. Yep. That's a good story. Watch out for those truck drivers to call him Mimi, man. Shit. Well, the terrorist hunter. You don't want to mess with me. You should have been like, "Listen, do you know who I am?
I don't think you realize.
You don't know who you're messing with, Jack. Well, I'm tracking you right now. Look up. You see that drone? Oh, no, you don't. That's exactly
run. Run now.
You better run. And I still can see you."
I guess I realized, make sure I have the money before I file the deed. That was a big lesson in that.
Yeah. Good point. All right. Tate the Big Papa, man. Big mistakes? What is it?
You know, I've made a few good mistakes. One mistake most recently that we made was we double sold a property for cash both times. So, or I guess we sold it once on terms, and then we sold it for cash, and we deeded the property to the second person, and we just made a mistake when we entered the APN into LG Pass. So we had the last digit was supposed to be a zero and we hit one. And so LG Pass didn't alert us that, "Hey, this property's already been sold," kind of thing. So I ended up having to go to the person who bought it for cash, and I explained the situation, and you know, he was pretty upset about it. And we told him, "Listen, we're going to make it right. Not only are we going to, you know, we can give you your money back, or I've got a similar property in the same area. And because we made a huge mistake, we're going to give you 10% off of it." And he ended up being okay with that. And same thing that Mimi just said, because we handled it professionally and we just kind of owned up to it and said, "Listen, this is our bad. There's no excuses. We simply messed up." He was very understanding in the long run. I mean, we did have a few heated text messages exchanged, but for the most part, he kind of cooled off and realized that mistakes happened. We weren't trying to keep his money. We were trying to give him his money back, actually. And he really wanted land out in that area. So we were able to move him on to something else. And then that's a mistake that's happened once or twice now. But one of my biggest mistakes ever was when I first got started, I found this honey hole where I could buy lots for like $100, $150 a piece. And I could sell them for cash for like $4,500. And I did like five or six of these deals. And one of my biggest mistakes or regrets is I ended up wholesaling like 20 lots in that area to a guy for $1,000 a piece. And because he bought them for $1,000, he took them to the marketplace and ended up selling them for like $2,500 cash and just destroyed the market there. And I regret doing that so much because I was sitting on 20 properties, but I got distracted by like the quick money and let him go for something that I shouldn't have done. Now I was happy at the time, right? I made $800 and everything was great. And then I went out and used that money and bought more land in that area and tried marketing them at $4,500. And because he sold all of those for so cheap, people weren't willing to pay that anymore. So that was one of my biggest mistakes.
All right. So that makes me want to like get on my soapbox here, right? Like,
I know. I'm sure you do. I'm sure you've got a good lecture in there for me.
Not just you, but like for everybody. Like, here's the thing. Like, I know I even talk about this in flight school. And people are like, whatever. And I know you guys are going to agree because I don't think anybody, I've ever seen anybody on this call do this. But here's the funny thing is that one, you know, like when you find kind of this little spot, it doesn't mean that, you know, like you have to always keep it to yourselves. But there is this thing about, I grew up in a corporate America kind of a deal. It's company confidential, right? Like, there's certain things you don't talk about. Fight Club is one of them. You don't talk about company secrets because it gives you the competitive advantage, right? There's little things that you always need to be doing to try to keep your competitive advantage. Here's what I love. I don't love it, but here's what my pet peeve is. Man, I see these groups on Facebook that are like the lots are hot and vacant land, you know, groups that people love to post their ads on, yet nobody ever responds to them. And I swear these groups are set up by other land investors to see where other land investors are investing.
They are.
Why are you wasting your time posting there?
I completely agree.
I mean, does anybody disagree with me? Like, no. You guys have any success with that?
I'll look in the feed to see if anyone's responding, and I never really see any responses.
Nobody. They're like, hey, I'm going to post here. You're posting the other land investors, which is cool, but now I know where you are. That's one of the things I don't like about Facebook, man. Like, hey, let's just all share.
It's like, thanks for giving me an inside look at your inventory, right?
I mean, I guess you could argue that kind of Landmoto does the same thing, but I don't know. I guess it doesn't really matter, right? I don't know. It depends. It
matters to you.
But look, to me, if you're going to post on Facebook, do what Mimi teaches, which is go to the market or go to the buy-sell groups, the local buy-sell groups. These things that are like lots are hot and everybody loves land. Nobody loves land except for you and me. That's it. And even then, I'm not sure that we love land. Like, we love the income stream that it produces. But the land to me is like, okay, cool. All right, I get off my soapbox now. And I will talk about kind of my a mistake that we just recently made. And this is one that was, look, we've made mistakes along the way. I've done the Scott Bossman mistake where you buy in as tenants in common or something else. And I probably made all these mistakes too. I don't know. Somewhere along the way, you can always make them better. But this one that we just did absolutely kills me. Here it is. We went out, we bought a property, and it was held joint tenants with rights of survivorship. Cool, right? The husband's deceased. No problem. Give us the death certificate. They did. So we bought this thing. We present the death certificate to the county. They record it. All is good. We sold the property for cash. The problem is that on the death certificate where it says marital status, it marked that he was divorced, not married. Therefore, because that death certificate was marked divorced, the joint tenants with rights of survivorship, which doesn't really make sense to me because it should transfer. The joint tenants with rights of survivorship split. And the fact is that they're telling us now we have to go through probate to clear that off. So we're fighting with the county right now to kind of get that resolved, because joint tenants with rights of survivorship is joint tenants with rights of survivorship, period, in the story. Doesn't matter. In our opinion, doesn't matter if they're divorced or not. They still have the right to it. So that's what we're working on. And that's kind of my biggest mistake right now. And I'll let you guys know how it works out, okay? So I'm sure we can get it fixed.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Passive Income podcast. Start your journey at www.thelandgeek.com and www.scotttodd.net. Rate and review the podcast and email support@thelandgeek.com. Your screenshot for a free passive income launch kit.